Yagya Pasava, the sacrificial animals. Anena, by him. Sagyapta, killed. Yea, all of them who. Adayaluna, by the most unkind. Kutarai, by axes. Chichidu, pierced to pieces. Kruda, being very angry. Smaranta, remembering. Amivam, sinful activity. Asya, of him. Tat, that. Translation. That most unkind king, Paranjana, had killed many animals in various sacrifices. Now, taking advantage of this opportunity, all these animals began to pierce him with their horns. It was as though he were being cut to pieces by axes. Purport by His Divine Grace, Sri Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Those who are very enthusiastic about killing animals in the name of religion or for food must await similar punishment after death. The word mamsa, meat, indicates that those animals whom we kill will be given an opportunity to kill us. Although in actuality no living entity is killed, the pains of being pierced by the horns of animals will be experienced after death. Not knowing this, rascals unhesitatingly go on killing poor animals. So-called human civilization has opened many slaughterhouses for animals in the name of religion or food. Those who are a little religious kill animals in temples, mosques, or synagogues, and those who are more fallen maintain various slaughterhouses. Just as in civilized human society the law is a life for a life, no living entity can encroach upon another living entity as far as the Supreme Lord is concerned. Everyone should be given freedom to live at the cost of the Supreme Father. And animal killing, either for religion or for food, is always condemned by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. In Bhagavad Gita 16:19, Lord Krishna says, Tamahan jistu Jisata kuram samsadeshu naradaman shipam yadasamasuban asurasevayonishu. Those who are envious and mischievous, who are the lowest among men, are cast by me into the ocean of material existence, into various demoniac species of life. The animal killers, drishata, envying other living entities and the Supreme Personality of Godhead, are placed in darkness and cannot understand the theme and objective of life. This is further explained in the following verses. Om Agnatinamandasya Ganajana Shalakaya Chakshuram Nitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. That most unkind king, Paranjana, had killed many animals in various sacrifices. Now, taking advantage of this opportunity, all these animals began to pierce him with their horns. It was as though he were being cut to pieces by axes. It's interesting to see in this purport how Srila Prabhupada repeats that whether for so-called religious purposes or for so-called food sources, animal killing is basically condemned And the very few exceptions to that rule are clearly defined in the scriptures. But in the age of Kali, which means the age of quarrel and hypocrisy, chief target of hypocrisy is religion. Because if Kali can spread his influence, his hideous influence of hypocrisy, into the realm of religion, there's really no need for him to target any other sources. Religion is that aspect of society which is meant to elevate everything else. And if that goes down, everything else goes down with it. And quarrel. Quarrel and hypocrisy are almost synonymous terms. Because if there is hypocrisy, especially in religion, there is no alternative then to be quarrel amongst the various living entities. Because the peace formula is simply to acknowledge that Krishna, aham sarvasya prabhavo, Krishna is the source of everything and everyone. Everything in existence, spiritual or material, emanates from him. Those who are wise and know this worship him with all their hearts and serve him unconditionally. It is only by acknowledging the one common factor, the one common denominator, the one central point of all existence that there can be peace and harmony. The only alternative to that understanding is that I'm the center. Ego means das, das, anadas. I'm servant of the servant. False ego means I'm the center. I'm the enjoyer. Everything revolves around me. But when you have unlimited sparks of the same fire, each thinking themselves the supreme and the center, then those sparks conflict, which causes the heat of conflict. And if blazed by the winds of adversity, burst into the conflagration called war, in which everyone is so sad to see their loved ones go to the battlefield, many of whom never to return, and can't understand. They question, they even criticize God. How can he allow such a thing, such a horrendous, horrible thing as war? And oftentimes nobody can even figure out what are people fighting about. Useless tracts of land that countless living entities sacrifice their life for. It makes no sense whatsoever from a superficial perspective. But those who understand the laws of karma, who can connect reaction to its source and action, can very easily understand that those who inflict cruelty and unnecessary pain and death upon others will be subjected to the reaction of that misdeed in that life and or future lives. So, quarrel and hypocrisy are the symptoms of Kali. Where we see the symptoms, quarrel and hypocrisy, we know that Kali, the personification of irreligion, is present. And if he can inflict his influence into the realm of religion, that destroys everything of any good and quality. And especially if he can inflict the principle of cruelty, which is the antithesis of religion, into the realm which is supposed to support and protect kindness, religion, then everything is destroyed, and Kali is successful in claiming this age, Kali Yuga, as his own. These symptoms were noticed just after the appearance of Lord Krishna. Maharaj Yudhisthira noticed them before he even received word that Krishna had left this planet along with truth and religion and all good qualities. He noticed the symptoms. And when Arjuna returned from Dwarka, he could see by his countenance that it was confirmed that their dear friend Krishna had indeed left. And with the symptoms of the oncoming age of Kali, the principle of sacrifice, which is meant to acknowledge Krishna as the center, as the enjoyer, as the controller, as the Lord and Master, became deviated into the antithesis of that sacrament in the form of animal slaughter. Of course, in the name of religion. And we know the very famous dialogue between Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and the Chankazi, in which the Chankazi was saying, well, you know, you have your Puranas and we have our Quran, all of which sanction animal killing. And Mahaprabhu would not compromise in the least. He said, animal sacrifice is quite different from animal killing. Animal sacrifice performed according to scripture and by qualified brahmanas elevates the soul of that animal. It benefits that animal and is considered an act of supreme benevolence, which benefits all participants, whereas animal killing just destroys everyone and everything involved and halts that soul's progress in the evolutionary cycle. And of course, if we want to believe that, you know, logic and argument or whatever is higher than the scriptural evidence, then we'll find plenty of evidence to support whatever misconceptions we want to believe. Many times when devotees will go to the doctor or someone and they'll tell you the hazards of a strictly vegetarian diet, there is some truth to what they say. One who lives on a diet which is totally bereft of any animal products is quite likely to have health problems related. But you see, a strictly vegetarian diet, so-called, is actually a product of technology. Another synonym for Kali. Age of quarrel, hypocrisy, machines, Iron Age, technology. By our technological conquest of the agricultural realm, we're able to produce so-called vegetarian bhoga, like grains and vegetables, which aren't even vegetarian. Actually, even today, fruit is not vegetarian because of the pesticides and the fertilizers, which are blood meal and bone meal based. Even you go to the store and buy vegetables and fruits, and grains are likely not to be vegetarian. But anyway, if you are strictly vegetarian, then you've done something not possible in previous ages. In previous ages, and more organic cultures, you can't really have a diet which is totally bereft of any animal products because there's little microbes and things, bugs, that you always miss. and somehow get into your diet, and that's all you need as far as animal food in your diet. You know, one or two of those a month, and that's your quota. If you're of the body type that needs it at all. Whereas, you know, maintaining slaughterhouses is just a sure formula for disaster in the world and pain and anguish for everyone involved. So, by the influence of Kali, quarrel produces friction, which ultimately breaks out in war. And hypocrisy culminates and terminates in slaughter in the name of religion, which is actually the antithesis of religion. So Maharaj Yudhisthira noticed the symptoms before he even learned that Krishna had indeed left the planet. But as soon as Krishna left, Kali invaded immediately. Krishna's presence in this world extended a little bit beyond what would have normally been the beginning of Kali Yuga, 25 years or so, during which Kali was not able to invade, waiting, anticipating Krishna's disappearance, at which point he invaded, with religion being his prime target. And then what happened on the world scene was that the so-called Vedic Brahmanas, who are entrusted with maintaining peace in the world, by the influence of Kali, they began performing what they called Vedic sacrifices, but were actually, because of their lack of qualification, was nothing better than animal slaughter. And when this became what was recognized as religion, and people were just accepting that killing animals is authorized Vedic activity, it necessitated a very dramatic move on the part of the Lord, that he empowered. In this age, he empowered. Other ages, the Lord came himself as Buddha to preach ahimsa as the main religious formula. And of course, the argument he had to meet was that these sacrifices are based on the Vedas. So Buddha, who is either empowered, as in this age, or the Lord himself, in other ages, had to say, if the Vedas condone animal killing, then I have to reject the Vedas. The Lord himself, in other ages, the Shaktavish avatar in this age, rejects the Vedas and preaches atheism. Why? It spread atheism far and wide, beyond India to China and Tibet and ultimately around the world. Why would the Lord inaugurate and spread the cause of atheism? Because it's better than animal killing. Of course, he followed up on that by sending Shankaracharya to preach impersonalism, which is worse yet, but to defeat the Buddhist influence, which is all to lead and pave the way up to the four founder acharyas, Nimbarkacharya, Madhva, Ramanuj III and Madhva, to set the cornerstones for the structure of the Sankirtan movement, to be endorsed later by the Lord himself in the form of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So, and what to speak of the holy Dham, the Lord's own garden, where you don't know who the living entities might be, because we know that those who are unsuccessful in going back to Godhead in their human form of life, even though they tried, generally take birth as animals. So if we go out and hunt in the holy Dham, you're quite likely shooting your godbrother. Or if you don't make it in this lifetime, which is practically impossible anyway, quite likely your God brother's going to shoot you in the next lifetime. Is this the kind of preaching we want to endorse? One of the first offenses to the Holy Dom, which is Balaram, the expansion of the Lord himself, is to commit violence to any of the living entities there. So you better be careful about inadvertently stepping on an ant or any such activity. What to speak of? When we take vows at the time of initiation, amongst which is no meat eating, it doesn't just mean you don't eat flesh. It means no cruelty. And you can say, well, you know, Krishna incited Arjuna to fight. But back up a little bit and look who is the most powerful emissary of peace trying to avert the battle of Kurukshetra. It's Krishna himself. And the whole thing was so painful to Balaram that he just had to go off on pilgrimage. He couldn't even stand to be around for the battle. It's too painful to him. To inflict pain on any living entity is nothing less than to inflict pain to the heart of the Lord himself, if it's unnecessary. There are cases where it is necessary. But you better be careful not to make a mistake in that regard. So the Holy Dom is to be respected as the expansion of the Lord. Balaram, who sets the scene, the stage for the Lord's pastimes. And what are the Lord's embellishments, decorations? We see now he's got a nice flower garland, but he's also got jewelry and fancy clothes and turban. You know, when Mother Jashoda comes into Krishna's bedroom singing sweet songs about their loving pastimes from days before, and she awakens Krishna, and all the cowherd boys come, and together they assist in dressing Krishna. And to please Mother Jashoda, he puts on jewelry and nice fancy clothes. And the cows, they won't even give milk until they have the darshan of Krishna, so, you know. But then what happens when Krishna goes to the forest? He takes off the fancy jewelry and things that Mother Jashoda gives him, or else it kind of gets covered with the forest gifts, the flowers and the peacock feathers and the minerals and the mango twigs. And Krishna decorates himself as described by the gopis. We're seeing this from about 20 miles away. Premanjana Charita Bhakti Valochinena, with eyes anointed with salve of love. They can very clearly see what's going on outside 20 miles away. And they say, why is he dressing so nice? How's he dressing? Like a dramatic actor, or somebody who's dramatic actor, or somebody who's about to do a stage performance or artistic dancing, and are watching in rapt suspension from inside their houses 20 miles away or so. Why is he dressing so nicely? Is he dressing to please the cowherd boys? Well, they're dressing him, so obviously that's not it. Dressing to please Mother Jashoda? Well, she already dressed him. Now he's dressing to... Who's he dressing to please? Well, who do young boys like to dress in order to please? Young girls. So the gopis are very happy. So, you know, Mother Jashoda and Nanda Maharaj and the elders, they follow Krishna until Krishna just assures them, well, look, you know, we'll be all right. You can go back and we'll be well behaved. And then with great pain, they turn and go back. And then, as the Acharya has explained, as soon as Nanda and Jashoda turn and go back, Krishna and the cowherd boys are like what? Like baby elephants who just got released. And if anybody's ever worked with baby elephants, they know that they like to laugh and leap around and stumble. And they're a very jovial, playful kind of animal. So the Cowherd boys are all playing and joking, and when devotees ask Prabhupada, what do the Cowherd boys talk about? Prabhupada said, nonsense, of course. But it's all got one purpose, it's all got one center, and that is the pleasure of Krishna, which creates harmony and peace and sweetness throughout all of creation. And carrying that message of peace by the process of Sankirtan is the most benevolent activity and the only antidote to this hideous influence of cruelty. So when Krishna and the Cowherd boys start to play, naturally the cows and the peacocks and the birds and everyone gets into a very playful mood. And the Cowherd boys, they also like to fight. How do they fight? With nuclear missiles and trident warheads? No, with flowers. They launch flowers at one another. And sometimes they play ball. And sometimes they bounce around on pogo sticks. Not the kind we use today, but the forest provides its own brand. And then Vrindavan Forest, it's not a dull, inert, inanimate forest full of darkness. It's everything's enlightened. So it creates, understanding Krishna's inner mood, it creates a stage. And then one of the Cowherd boys starts drawing out his design, how the stage should be, with a stick in the earth. He says, okay, this is the center stage for Krishna and Balaram, who come on Krishna like a sapphire and Balaram like a emerald. And Krishna's bluish effulgence cast a nice hue over all the forest. And Balaram, when he gets enlivened, he starts sparkling like a crystal, like lightning. And this Cowherd boy from the center stage draws out a line, okay, the musician Cowherd boys can go on this side, and the deer and the rabbits and the birds, they can sit on this side. So everybody creates an audience. And then Krishna and Balaram come on stage. They bow down to the audience. They bow down to Bhumi, the stage, to Saraswati, the goddess of music and dance and art and song. And then they begin to dance. Krishna begins dancing like a peacock. And the earth planet is so blessed that nowhere else in the universe does Krishna dance. Does he even appear and bless the planet with the emblems of his bare lotus feet? So Krishna begins to dance, and everyone begins to sing. And Krishna begins to adjust his clothing in very accentuated manner for a drama. And then Krishna begins tap dancing, creating a musical rhythm. And as Krishna and Balaram are dancing together, they each become so absorbed in their mutual love for one another. And everyone witnessing this Leela becomes so filled with love for Krishna and Balaram that their natural impulse is to just embrace and love one another. When you have love for Krishna, you cannot have enmity towards anyone or anything. And then Krishna begins playing his flute. And this enlivens Balaram to start dancing in a way that no one can imitate. When Balaram gets very enlivened, how would you compare? Like in Russia, they have these very interesting kind of dancers. But Balaram is really the best. He gets so enlivened that with one hand on the ground and his whole body pivoting in the air and his lotus feet circling in the sky, that just enlivens Krishna to no end, so that Krishna cannot even contain his joy. And Krishna begins dancing, which culminates in doing cartwheels around Balaram, who's rotating on his hand with his body in the air, and Krishna's doing cartwheels circumambulating him while simultaneously playing his flute, while simultaneously taking the dust from Balaram's feet in the air and also distributing that dust to everyone in the audience, until finally all that anybody can say is, "Wonderful, wonderful." And Krishna begins boasting, "Can anybody in the world imitate or outdo us in dancing?" There's no way. You know, first there's competition. Okay, who's the best? And the cowherd boys, to please Krishna, they dance the best. But finally, Krishna and Balaram dance even better, until everyone and the forest and the earth is so enthralled, and the sound penetrating even the outer coverings of the universe, reaching Vaikuntha, Lord Narayan begins smiling, and Lakshmi, "What is causing you so much pleasure?" Of course, he doesn't talk much about the pastimes in Vrindavan, because Lakshmi Devi is not pleased by that. There's such a beautiful correlation between love and wonder that everyone is just enraptured in this dance. And then, as Srila Prabhupada points out, Krishna and Balaram had not undergone the hair-cutting ceremony at this time, so everything is dancing. Their earrings, their hair, their garlands, their eyebrows, their ornaments, their clothes, the forest, the sky, everything. And, of course, our acharyas are so expert, they've extracted all this detail from one verse of the 10th canto. Premanjana charita bhakti vilochinena. If we have love, there will be no room for malice in our hearts. There was a time in New Vrindavan when we were building a building and there was not enough devotees for all the construction activities. So there was a Karmi crew here building the building, and I was kind of overseeing it. And until this day, I could never in my life understand why anyone would eat meat. It just, the reasoning totally evaded me. And on this day, when I was working with this crew indirectly, and when it came lunchtime, they said, "Okay, it's lunchtime." So I gave them prasadam. And all the workers were delighted except for their foreman, who said, "Where's the meat?" I said, "Well, you don't eat meat." I said, "Well, I do." I said, "Well, just, you know, take prasadam and you'll be..." And he got offended. I'd never seen anything like this before. So I was like, you know, what to do? He said, "I have to have meat if I'm going to work." So what to do? "Oh, okay. Well, we got plenty of meat. I just remembered a cow had died the night before." So I showed him, "Look, here's all the meat you'd ever want." And I thought he'd be happy. I thought it was Krishna's arrangement that a cow had just died, but it actually was Krishna's arrangement for another reason that I had envisioned. I've never seen a person's features suddenly turn so hideous. It's like his whole countenance transformed, and from a low-class construction worker, he like started to appear like a rakshasa. He was infuriated that I offered him meat. I'm like, "What is going on?" course, I'm always trying to seek the lesson and the wisdom in any of it, but this baffled me. And then suddenly it dawned on me. People like to eat meat because they want to be lord over the lives of other living entity. It is the ultimate expression of envy. You know, you can say, well, you know, somebody envies me for my truck. I don't know if anybody envies my truck. Anyway, or maybe somebody envies somebody else's wealth or bank account. Or, I mean, those things go on in life. But to envy the very life of another living entity, that's the motivation for meat eating. And that's why it tastes good to them. Because it confirms that your ego's hunger. Yeah, you're the Lord. You're living on the lives of these poor, innocent living entities. So malice. It is not by hatred or fighting that malice can be killed, but only by love is envy stilled. It's a lesson repeatedly emphasized and demonstrated in the life of Haridas Thakur, who changed the hearts of even those cruel, vicious Muslim executioners who were assigned to destroy his life. And the symptom of love is humility, service attitude. Because it's not like, you know, lubby-dubby hippies who just love everyone and everything and don't do anything. The expression is service. And who's the best servant? Krishna's the best everything. He's also the most humble. Because after this dance, this theatrical performance which enchanted and enraptured the whole world, and everyone is saying, yeah, Krishna, you're the best. And Krishna, yeah, I am the best. And then Sridham comes over and says, hey, Krishna, you know, I've got evidence that under the cloak of darkness, you sneak out sometimes and take dancing lessons from my older sister. Sridham is Radharani's younger brother. So Krishna, you know, and Krishna, yeah, you know, it's actually kind of presumptuous for me to proclaim myself to be the supreme dancer because I've got my own teacher. So if you're envious of Krishna because he's so great, consider that he's also the most humble. That's not even really true, because the greatest and most humble, most filled with love personality in all creation is Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Of course, this is all so esoteric and over our heads that we should understand that we really have no connection with anything and anything in the spiritual except by the grace of our spiritual master. The supreme expression of kindness, mercy, and love, who's come to redeem us from our plight in this world and save us from the viciousness which just destroys everything and everyone in this world. And teaching us how to sing and dance in Sankirtan. Sankirtan has two meanings. It means everyone coming together to sing and dance. It also means everything being used in the missionary work of Srila Prabhupada and Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to develop love for Krishna, which is the purpose of our chanting Hare Krishna. Just as our acharyas extract so much detailed lila out of one verse of Srimad Bhagavatam, by one mantra, which consists of three names, Hare, Krishna, and Rama, we can revive our dormant Krishna consciousness and counteract all the evil tendencies of the age of Kali, perfect the human form of life, benefit all living entities by assisting one another on the path back home, where everyone lives eternally in perfect peace and harmony in and goodwill. Thank you very much. Are there any comments or questions? Love and thus. Krishna what? Yeah, yeah. Yes. Krishna empowers Kali to personify irreligion to such an extreme degree that all religious systems fail as a setting for the supreme universal religious principle only to be victorious and highlighted and create the setting for Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Srila Prabhupada to establish that Harinam Sankirtan is the essence and the goal of all the Vedas. It goes right along with the whole package of Buddha and Shankaracharya and Kali and all these apparently adversities, but actually setting the scene, setting the stage for Harinam Sankirtan to emerge supremely victorious. Param Vijayate Shri Krishna Sankirtanam for that purpose. What's that? Yeah. Well, as the 11th canto explains, that in this age, the demigods who have been waiting and yearning to take birth in the Sankirtan movement come. But not everyone in the world is demigods and assistants of the Lord. It's a mixture of very condemned living entities, shackled in the chains of Kali, and fortunate living entities. And it's a time of polarization. That those who are movement, the universe is filled with both liberated souls and demigods who are trying to become supremely liberated, and just the ordinary living entities who are condemned to this age. So it's a mixture of all these things. So most will accept the irreligious aspect, but even if a small percentage accepts the Sankirtan movement, the whole course of history will be dramatically altered. So yeah, it's not surprising that most people don't accept the supreme gift. It's like, say you got a little ant, and you give him a little grain of sugar, and he'll eat it and say, thank you very much. If you give him a big diamond, he's not going to appreciate it. It's just like an obstacle to him, something he's got to walk around. When the Sankirtan movement is given in the age of Kali, it's so beyond the intellectual capacities of humans, what to speak of anybody else, to appreciate, that they're just like that little ant in the diamond. It's just like a botheration to them. And that's where the grace, which is expressed by preaching, is essential, that we try to express to people, even if they have no ability to understand. Just by taking prasadam, by seeing the loving interactions between devotees, the hardest hearts can be softened. So it's not surprising that initially most people do not accept, but rather reject and even oppose the Sankirtan movement, but it will be supremely victorious in time. Because he established this as New Vrindavan not in name only, but he gave the vision, he gave the instructions, and he gave the blessings for this place to be a replica of Vrindavan. He didn't do it exactly the same way other places. Like, you know, even the names, they're not arbitrary. Like, you know, they had one name for chosen out for Gita Nagari, and then Prabhupada said, no, name it Gita Nagari. Prabhupada had this very specific vision for different places. Laguna Beach was New Jarikanda because the living entities there were like forest creatures, not creatures of the holy land of Braja forest, but like Jarikanda forest. But Prabhupada named it New Vrindavan. He gave a vision and a blessing for it to be just like, even better than Vrindavan. And these instructions in this name and everything is not just arbitrary. It's a very specific spiritual reality that creates a special sanctity and mood to the place. So we have to revere it as being what Prabhupada said, even if we can't see it or realize it on all levels. I'm lechus, chatrius.
Yeah. These are all just religions.
That's a very complex topic. From the absolute perspective, you can see it all as a reflection of what's going on in Bharatvarsha. The different Western religions, from Moses to Muhammad, the reflections of the different rasas that became the prevalent modes of worship in Bharatvarsha. And just like the sun, which rises in the east and gradually casts its rays to the west, although maybe diffused, it's a reflection of what's going on in Bharatvarsha. So Moses gave to the Western world a kind of santaras, the greatness and glory of God. Jesus condensed that and introduced a higher concept, God as Father, which is, well, Muhammad first gave God as friend. Or say, no, actually before Moses there was Santaras, so say Moses gave us Dasiras, or servant of the Supreme, Dasya. Sakya is Muhammad, God is friend. That's what he preached, that was his mood. To Jesus, God is Father, which is Vatsalya. It's the same as we say Nanda is the perfection of Vatsalya because Krishna is his son. And he's, you know, accepting Mother Yashoda as his mother in all respects. That whether God is son or God is father, it's Vatsalya. And then Madhurya never really reached the western shores until Prabhupada came with Krishna book. So these are empowered preachers. No doubt they had their divine revelations. But since they did not have a scientific form of sampradaya, disciplic succession, then their scriptures and their teachings got very much mixed. And therefore, you can look through the Bible or look through the Quran and see sections that are definitely divine revelation. And you see other sections are just ghastly. It's a conglomeration of all kinds of different things, these scriptures. So therefore, you find Mahaprabhu and you find Srila Prabhupada sometimes endorsing them as being, you know, excellent. Whereas other times, Mahaprabhu, in his, when he'd get like more into his Aishwarya, especially of Lord Nrisimha flavor, you just want to kill them all. He's just, you know, he's kind of like just disgusted with the ghastly part and kind of overlooked the divine revelation. But he wouldn't stay in that mood forever. You know, the devotees would pacify him and he'd get more reasonable again. So they're mixed. And that's why so many of us were attracted to Srila Prabhupada's teachings. There was nothing inconsistent in what he was presenting. And we never discovered that in our search through different religions and philosophies. So it's both. It's mixed. But, you know, when Srila Prabhupada was walking in, or was it Boston, New York, and he saw that sign, unadulterated steel, he liked it. Because we're presenting unadulterated religion and philosophy. You know, religion was there all along, and there was, you know, some truth to it, but it was adulterated with so many other things. Karma Kanda, Jnana Kanda, and even much lower things. So, because they did not have the protection of Sampradaya and Veda, you know, authorized, empowered scripture, they're subject to all this interpolation. Anything else? Thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.